Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Wyoming House of Representatives has joined the state Senate in passing a bill that would strip a number of powers from the state superintendent and give them to a governor-appointed director of education. The superintendent would remain on state boards and commissions with the other four elected officials and would serve on the state board of education, among other duties. But the new director would run the state Department of Education. Top lawmakers crafted the legislation right before the legislative session, and many believe that the legislature is moving too quickly. But some observers say the move is overdue. Bob Beck reports from Cheyenne.
Legislators who supported the bill say it came to this point because Superintendent Cindy Hill did not embrace a number of education reforms the legislature passed 2 years ago. Some of those reforms included new accountability measures that supporters hope will improve teaching and increase test scores. They charged that Hill's office missed deadlines, and turnover in her office kept the Department of Education from completing mandated tasks. Senate Education Chairman Hank Coe says it was frustrating.
So this didn't come lightly. This isn't something that we wanted to do. This is something that we felt we had no other option but to do. And that's unfortunate.
Coe says a big part of the problem is that over the last 2 years, employees were run off by Hill.
You know, we've had a 40% turnover down there in the last year. 40% turnover. And you can't have that type of turnover and get the heavy lifting done that has to happen with education accountability. All the good people down there that were there that had an institutional knowledge of the Department of Education and how it worked aren't there. Refused to work for it.
For her part, Superintendent Hill has referred to the legislative accountability measures as micromanaging, and she says there is more to education than just doing administrative work.
We think that there's some magic bullet here. It's not a magic bullet, and we can't go backwards. We know it works. We see the results. The results are there, Bob. They're there. Look. We know that what we've been doing matters.
Hill adds that it is clear her approach has worked.
The test scores are up statewide. You're hearing that they're not. And I say always ask the person their source. Our state assessment has been up in every subject since I came in.
But they are not up high enough for supporters of the legislation. Wyoming consistently ranks among the top 10 states in education spending, and many say test scores and graduation rates should match that spending, but it hasn't. Bill Schilling of the Wyoming Business Alliance is among those who have been critical about the state's education standing. Schilling's group was instrumental in getting the Hathaway Scholarship through the legislature. That allows students to get money to attend the University of Wyoming and the community colleges if they meet certain education criteria. Schilling says it is time that the state hire an education director who can not only run the department, but who can also provide some consistent vision.
And kids will aspire to greatness if they're given the nudge. But we have to be on the same, we've got to be at the same table together. So I think it's a great opportunity, quite frankly.
Another person who thinks it's time for a change might be a surprise. Trent Blankenship was the superintendent of public instruction for 2 years when his own battles with legislators and the governor convinced him to resign the post. Blankenship says having an appointed director run the State Department of Education is likely wise. But Blankenship says the legislature is moving too quickly. He thinks the issue should have been taken to the public.
It would really be generative for the state to have a conversation about how do we govern the schools at the state level in a way that increases their effectiveness, that increases the representation of local communities, and provides the state government a way to effectively administer the whole piece in its most cost-effective and efficient manner possible.
But Ray Lynn Job, who was a teacher, administrator, and state senator in Wyoming, says that conversation has occurred, and it was Blankenship who thwarted it. Job reminds us that over a decade ago, she was part of the legislature that approved its own massive school reform effort that attempted to improve accountability, graduation rates, and other issues.
That was a great project, and it was going along really well until we had an election and a new state superintendent came in who didn't like it, thwarted it totally by getting rid of the assessment people who were leading that effort. And so it languished for years, and now it's back again, where it could have been operating and changing teaching practices in the classroom all this time.
Job says this shows there has always been a tension between the legislature's efforts to improve education and the state superintendent. That's why she supports the bill, saying that the appointed position has been needed for a while. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
As the legislature gave final approval to a bill that removes power from the state superintendent, Wyoming Public Radio's Luke Hammonds took to the streets in Laramie to ask the public what they think.
I'm Sandy Kassir, and I'm from Laramie, Wyoming. I understand the legislator's frustration with her and her department. However, she is a constitutionally elected official, and I suspect that our best way of removing her would be through a constitutional amendment.
My name is Jenny Hall, and I'm from Cheyenne, Wyoming. I think that so far the superintendent hasn't really fulfilled the responsibilities that she was given, and then the legislature needs to come in and step in and do something, because if we were to let this go on for another 2 years till the election time again, I think it would just create more problems. So I think if they need to do damage control, then I think that's okay. All the other elected officials are kind of fulfilling their responsibilities, and she's not. So I think it's important that somebody come in and make sure that she does.
My name is Jim Rubino. I'm from Laramie, Wyoming. I think it's bogus. I mean, I think a couple years ago, we voted her in, and now they're basically just disavowing our vote. So to me, it's just completely unconstitutional for the Wyoming Constitution, and I'm totally against it.
My name is Carol Kirkwood, and I'm from Laramie. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught for almost 40 years in the system, and I really think that the state superintendent position should be an elected one. So I don't feel like, I don't feel as though the legislature should be the ones to decide that. I feel that that should be a public decision and open to election.
Karen Williams, and I live here in Laramie. I have not personally been happy at all with how Cindy Hill has been managing the Department of Education. I think that the people in the state of Wyoming should have the opportunity to vote on an amendment to get rid of the superintendent as an elected position and change it into an appointed position. I don't think the legislature should take that right away from the people and create this new entity. I feel that having two people working with education for our state is going to be confusing, unworkable, and it's going to cost the taxpayers more money at a time when the agencies are taking budget cuts. The university is going to face a budget cut.
My name is Dixie May, and I'm from Laramie. I just hate to see another office started, because that's just more government.
Margaret Cage. I live west of Laramie on a ranch. I'm a rancher. I think we need to find some way to get her out, but I don't think we should give up our right to elect a superintendent of schools.
My name is Tom Schmidt. Now, I've heard talk saying that this position is too important to be elected to, the superintendent. And if that's the case, then maybe we should just have the legislature appoint the governor and the secretary of state also.
A problem for children who are diagnosed with cancer in Wyoming is finding local care. Treatment typically requires long drives to cities, but Wyoming's Comprehensive Cancer Control Program is trying to change that. The program has hired an oncologist who specializes in pediatric care to come to Casper once a month to treat children. Plans are underway to get more doctors involved in the effort. The pediatric oncologist is Dr. John Van Doornik, who joined me at the state capitol earlier this week to discuss the program.
If you're a child and you're diagnosed with cancer in the state of Wyoming, one of the challenges is that there is not a specialized cancer center in the state of Wyoming, and therefore, in addition to dealing with the diagnosis and the emotional difficulties involved, the family has to relocate, usually to Denver, to a specialized center where cancer care can be provided.
And this could be no matter where they are in the state. I mean, they may have to go quite a distance.
That's right. That's right. For example, many of the patients that I see at the Rocky Mountain Hospital for Children, some of them are from Casper, and that's 277 miles one way, 554 miles round trip. And so it's a considerable distance.
So tell me about this effort to maybe address that.
Well, the Wyoming Comprehensive Cancer Control Consortium, since its inception in about 2005, has identified as one of its initiatives finding a pediatric oncology provider to come to the state to provide certain services which would mitigate some of the burden of travel for the families. And additionally, I, since practicing in Denver, have acquired many patients from Wyoming and have noticed how far they need to come for sometimes routine follow-up care. And so I have wanted to come up here to Wyoming, and the WCCCC has wanted a pediatric provider up here in Wyoming, and I've been very happy to accept their invitation to come up here and have clinics. And so what we're doing is we're having monthly clinics, and at that clinic I come up and I see many of our patients in routine follow-up care. Additionally, we provide consultative services for physicians in the area, and we're integrating ourselves into certain psychosocial and community support networks to foster the ancillary needs of a child and their family who's been diagnosed with cancer.
Can you get other docs to help you with this? And, you know, obviously you're going to need someone like you for some of the specialty care, but for follow-up care and that sort of thing, are you able to form, I guess, a working group or something like that?
Absolutely, and that is one of the, I think, visions of the WCCCC, and that is empowering local physicians in two ways. One is that we are working with adult oncologists who are willing to give routine chemotherapeutic infusions that can safely be done here in Wyoming, and ameliorating the need for the children to come to Denver for certain treatments. Second, in follow-up, there are many issues associated with pediatric oncology survivorship. There are physical tolls that are taken on the body. There are psychological tolls. And so we are empowering local physicians and mental health experts through education so that they can take on some of the role of follow-up care and social support, which up to this point has mostly been provided at the specialty centers in Denver.
Can you talk a little bit about the Cancer Consortium and your impressions? We've talked with them in the past, but I'm just kind of curious as an outsider what you've thought of them.
I'm very, very impressed. This organization, I would say, dates back to about 2004. At that point, the CDC had a very ambitious national agenda to have a cancer control coalition in every state. The application on behalf of Wyoming was submitted by a small group of people who became the WCCCC, and since that time, they have started on a limited budget of $260,000 a year, have started a very ambitious program, and some of the sub-aims involve pediatric cancer. What has been accomplished on a limited budget in a short amount of time is very impressive, and one of the most impressive things is that it's been a very grassroots effort by people who are passionate about the cause. Specific accomplishments include data resource gathering of number of diagnoses, what was diagnosed, where and when in the state of Wyoming, to help paint a picture, a numerical picture of the problem of pediatric cancers in Wyoming. And this is a first and essential and hard step which was done. Second was compiling a database of every family and child who was diagnosed with cancer in the state of Wyoming so that when there was pertinent information, any resource that was available that would be important to these people, that it could be quickly and efficiently distributed to them. The WCCCC has also identified that there are specific psychological needs of patients who have battled cancer in childhood and who are now in the survivorship phase or who are still battling the cancer.
Dr. Van Dornick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Those who want more information can contact the State Comprehensive Cancer Control Program through the Wyoming Department of Health.
When we come back, we'll talk with Senator Mike Enzi about his ideas for ending bipartisan bickering on the Senate floor. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the State Capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. Wyoming Senior U.S. Senator Mike Enzi is the ranking member on the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, and also sits on the Budget and Finance Committees. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with him about a number of issues the Senate will be facing this year. Enzi says he thinks Congress has been neglecting the role of committees, and that's why it's been harder to get things done.
I'm making a big pitch back here that we need to get back to using committees, coming up with a basic bill that's bipartisan. That matches my 80% rule I found when I was working with Senator Kennedy, that we could agree on 80% of the issues, and if we stuck to the 80%, we could agree on 80% of any one of those issues. There was always 10% that each of us had that were kind of out there on the fringe, and if we left that out, we were able to get a lot done. But it's essential that it goes to committee, where the people that are intensely interested in that issue get a chance for input and amendments and a basic bill, and then that comes to the floor and it's allowed to be amended. And a lot of times people, if they are able to voice the concern of their constituents and have a vote on it, even if they lose, they're more comfortable with the bill. But a lot of times what they're bringing up are unintended consequences that people wouldn't have thought of because they didn't have the right background for it. That's essentially why we have 535 people in Congress, is so that we can cover as many of the unintended consequences and eliminate them before the bill goes into law. And if you skip the committee process and you skip the floor amendments, what you've done is taken away the rights of people across America to be represented by their congressmen and senators.
So with the fiscal cliff being averted for now, what needs to happen to address the budget?
It's statutorily required that we do a budget, and we need to have a fiscal blueprint. We can't keep spending money we don't have. We have trillion-dollar deficits that go right to the debt. That means that our grandchildren, well, actually it's escalating so much now that our kids are going to start paying it off, but we're going to have some significant spending cuts. And we're not using the committee process like we should. We're waiting until deadlines and then having deal makers do it instead of legislators. We've got to start legislating on these things. And we're required by April 15th to come up with a budget. Then I just co-sponsored a bill that if it isn't done, we won't be paid. No work, no pay. And I hope that that will actually be a part of the budget resolution and become a permanent part of the budget.
Coming back to the committee process, over the years, committees have been formed to try and find solutions. How realistic is it that you could have your colleagues in government help you come up with cuts like they have in Wyoming?
It used to work that way. I've been on the budget committee for 14 years, and for 10 of those years, we actually had a bipartisan process that approved a budget. But the last 4 years, we haven't been through that process. We haven't made it out of committee with it, so it definitely hasn't made it to the floor. It's really essential to getting people together and having everybody's fingerprints. The cuts are the toughest thing that there is to make, because there isn't a single thing that the federal government does that doesn't have a constituency out there, even if it's something that the federal government probably shouldn't have been involved in to begin with. Every problem doesn't have a federal solution. This is a huge nation with a lot of people, and most countries are about the size of one of our states. And so states usually come up with better solutions, just as Wyoming comes up with a better budget process than the federal government. They're able to get into the detail a lot more. Our budget is so big that we really ought to go to the biennial budgeting that I've talked about, which is to cover half of the budget each year rather than the whole thing. And maybe we could meet the deadlines then of having appropriations done by October 1st and have some good detail in reviewing it. At the present time, my penny plan is probably the only way we're going to be able to make any cuts, and that's to take 1% off of absolutely everything for each of 5 years. And in 5 years, the budget would balance.
On the topic of health care, now that the election is over, is there any movement on working on the Affordable Care Act to try to make the law more understandable and to get rid of parts of the law that either conflict or are not workable?
I would hope so. Again, if that goes through the committee process and they allow some some changes, but I think the president thinks that he has a pretty perfect health care bill and is not willing to allow any of that to happen, which takes away some of the incentive for the committees to actually take a look at that. But as time goes by, people are going to realize how much it raises taxes and how much more it spends, and that it isn't sustainable, and that exchanges could work, but not with all of the mandates that they've got. So there are changes that are absolutely going to have to be made. We took $716 billion out of Medicare when it was already going broke. And we have problems with Social Security, which is that every month we're paying out more than we're taking in, and we'll soon use up the trust fund on that. Medicare, there is no trust fund for it. It's already paying out more than it's taking in. And some of the choices that we'll have to make on that will make it pretty tough on people that are on Medicare. But if we can make changes in the health care law, there are ways we can cover all of those things.
So what changes would you like to see within the existing law that might make it more workable for Wyoming?
I'd like to see more capability across state borders. I had a bill years ago that Senator Kennedy actually helped a little on, and that was for small business health plans. And that's where people could group together through their organization to get a big enough group that they'd have clout to negotiate with the insurance companies. Or there's a provision under the bill for forming a co-op. They could form a co-op and do their own insurance. I'd like to see them eliminate some of the mandates. They're telling people exactly how much of what kind of insurance they need to have. Every person doesn't need that kind of insurance. If we did a health exchange that allowed all companies to put in what kind of things they're going to cover and how much they cost, people would be able to make some logical decisions, I think, on which would be the best company for them. I think it would put a lot more competition in the market, and that, too, would bring down the prices.
Senator Enzi, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure. Thank you.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez speaking with U.S. Senator Mike Enzi. Enzi sits on the Senate Budget and Finance Committees and is the ranking member on the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions.
When we come back, we'll look at the reaction Wyoming's congressional delegation had to President Obama's inaugural address, and we'll hear about new air quality projects and sublet in Converse counties. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. Wyoming's congressional delegation is not happy with what they heard in President Obama's second inaugural address. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the state's three Republicans in Congress are already preparing to blunt what's being both hailed and decried as a liberal second-term agenda.
Inauguration speeches are often about ideals, universal themes that inspire. While President Obama's speech included many soaring themes about unity and the national character, he also laid down his agenda. He's calling for addressing climate change, improving the immigration system, changing voter laws, and improving the health care system, an aggressive agenda that Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says lacks any spirit of bipartisanship.
I was very surprised by his tone. He was addressing issues that he has not raised as emphatically in the past. It was non-conciliatory in its tone. It was, I thought, an abrasive, in-your-face, ideological message.
The president's call for combating global warming shocked many people, especially those from energy-producing states like Wyoming. Mr. Obama used his second inaugural address to call for drastically curbing carbon emissions. Lummis says that's going to cripple the president's relationship with Republicans.
Areas of such contention and disagreement it was totally antagonistic to a working relationship on energy issues and environmental issues more specifically related to clean air, clean water, clean land.
Lummis and other Republicans, who control the House, are focused on expanding oil and gas drilling and ending some renewable energy tax breaks. That's why the chair of the Senate Environment Committee, Barbara Boxer of California, wants the president to bypass Congress altogether and use the power of the Environmental Protection Agency.
EPA has control over probably about more than 70% of the problem. Electric sources are responsible for a good portion, industrial sources, and transportation.
Lummis says bypassing Congress will just lead to more anger, along with protracted court battles. She says it'd be better if the administration sought to find a middle ground with Congress.
The EPA has been slapped down by the courts for exceeding their authority. If the president's tone is going to play out at the regulatory level, I'm convinced that we're going to see a lot more lawsuits where the courts are going to have to rein in the EPA.
Wyoming senators were also stunned by the president's inaugural message, specifically by what they didn't hear on Monday. John Barrasso says something important was missing.
The president mentioned neither the word spending nor debt, in spite of the fact that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said that the greatest threat to our national security was our debt.
Barrasso says the address drew a stark line in the sand.
So Democrats in the Senate are now going to have to make a choice. Do they agree with the president that spending is not a problem? Or do they agree with their constituents at home who are focused on the fact that they are burdening our children and grandchildren with a mountain of debt, burying them under that mountain of debt?
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi says it's even worse than that.
We talk about how we've mortgaged the future of our grandkids. Actually, we're up to the point where we're already mortgaging the future of our kids, and we're about to finish off the seniors.
Enzi is sponsoring legislation called No Budget, No Pay. The concept is as simple as the name. If there's no budget, lawmakers don't get paid. Last year, the entire Senate rejected the president's budget, and Senate Democrats didn't even release their own. Enzi says it's time for leadership on fiscal issues.
And we talk about the $16 trillion in debt. Nobody's talking about the way that that's increasing not only $1 trillion a year, but we are never decreasing it.
Enzi says he's already dubious about what he's hearing from the president.
Now, he said that he's not going to meet his legal deadline for submitting a budget.
Enzi says when that budget does come out, he'll be looking to see if the president is honest with the American people about how expensive his agenda really is. All told, Congresswoman Lummis says she's not very optimistic about how Washington is going to function in the coming years.
So I anticipate a very hostile relationship with the Obama administration based only on his remarks in his acceptance speech.
This week, House Republicans extended the nation's debt ceiling without demanding an equal amount of spending cuts. That gives the two sides some breathing room before the next clash over spending consumes Washington. And if Wyoming's lawmakers are any indication, the next battle promises to be a bloody one. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Sublette County violates federal air quality standards because of high levels of ozone, or smog. The ozone forms when emissions from oil and gas development mix together under certain weather conditions. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for fixing the problem, but there are a lot of unknowns about how ozone forms. Now, researchers at the University of Wyoming are trying to find some answers. We're joined now by Rob Field. He's an atmospheric scientist, and he's been monitoring air quality in Sublette County for several years.
Initially, our work was focused upon a better understanding of where ozone was coming from. Was it coming from the stratosphere? Was it coming from far away? And that research, in combination with the Wyoming DEQ's research as well, led us to realize that it was a locally produced ozone, a local problem. So then we spent the last 2 years looking at the compounds which create ozone. So that's oxides of nitrogen and volatile organic compounds. So the last 2 years, we've been trying to get a better understanding of where these compounds come from and which ones are the most important. And what we have discovered are two quite significant hotspots of VOC concentrations. One is on the Pinedale Mesa and the other in an area quite near Boulder. So we've been looking at those and trying to better understand why the levels are higher there and maybe what we can do about that in the future.
And to be clear, these areas with higher levels are areas where there's a lot of gas development.
Yeah, indeed. One area on the Mesa is associated with production, lots of drilling, lots of gas being produced. The second area, interestingly enough, is associated with a water treatment facility. So that's a handling of wastewater, where water is actually recycled for reuse in fracking operations. So we've got two very different signatures, and that's interesting for us as scientists, but also for the regulators in terms of finding the best ways for ozone control in the future.
And now you've just got funding for a new project in the area. What are you going to be doing? What are you trying to find out there?
Well, this project's really exciting because technology's improved. Often our regulatory monitoring approaches, we have a monitoring station that's at a fixed location, and we just park the facility there and measure continuously. To get good results, maybe we'd leave it there for 3 to 5 years, and we see that with the DQ network sites. But what we have is now the capability to have instruments that have a very fast response time, so we can actually drive on a designated circuit around the development, inside the development, outside the development, so that we can get a map or a picture of the pollution real time.
And so this will tell you, okay, we have emissions coming from a particular well pad, or we have emissions coming from a particular compressor station, or it'll get down to that detail.
If we're lucky, we might be able to make statements like that. But as this first phase of the project, we're going to keep moving. We're not going to stop. And we're going to see, are there areas that are consistently high? Are there areas that are consistently low? And then we're going to look at the meteorological conditions. We're going to be making thousands of measurements on every run. So that's going to be the power of this project, to give us lots of data so that maybe we can better understand this ozone system.
Now, in addition to the Sublette County project, you're also going to be starting some similar air quality monitoring in Converse County, where, of course, there's also new energy development there. It's mostly oil development that's happening. Tell us about what you're going to be doing there.
Well, we have a contract with the Wyoming BLM. Very pleased to get this work, because we're going to be doing baseline air quality monitoring. So often we might want to be monitoring air quality because there's a problem, but sometimes we might want to monitor air quality so that we can understand the conditions prior to development. So there's some federal mineral development proposed in the northeastern area of Converse County. So my mobile laboratory is going to be placed in Blizzard Heights on the Ross Road, just north of the Cameco uranium facility, and there we hope to get a really good signature of background air quality, not just for Converse County, but actually for this part of Wyoming.
Is this early enough to get baseline data? Obviously, a lot of this energy development has started already.
Yeah, that's always a problem. In fact, there's no such thing as an ultra-clean baseline monitoring. Even on the Western US, we're influenced by emissions from Asia. So it's always a problem. You're never going to have the perfect monitoring site, but the location we've selected is not – there's limited development in that area at this time. So we're confident this will give us a pretty good indication of background baseline conditions.
Now, in some of the stories that we've done in the past about Converse County, about new energy development that's happening there, some of the residents have voiced concerns about air quality. They've said, we're concerned that we might become another Pinedale. How similar are these two areas, really? Is that a valid comparison?
Well, that both areas, are, of course, influenced by energy development, but from the point of view of air quality emissions, I see there is a big difference between emissions from a wet natural gas field like Pinedale and this oil development that we see in Converse County. I'd expect Converse County to have lower emissions, but that's just an assertion based upon predictions. So what we want to do is supplement our static monitoring for baseline conditions with mobile monitoring, so that we can cover areas where people have concerns and be able to compare that back to the baseline monitoring.
All right, Rob Field, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
Rob Field is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Wyoming. He was speaking with us about air quality monitoring that he'll be doing in Sublette County and in Converse County.
The School of Energy Resources at the University of Wyoming is funded in large part with money from the energy industry. Other universities have gotten heat lately for not being open with their funding sources. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports that some stakeholders are concerned about too much influence from energy at UW, but SER promises transparency.
One of the newest buildings on University of Wyoming's campus is the School of Energy Resources Energy Innovation Center. It's still under construction, though already in use. The building is a nice embodiment of what SER has done since its founding in 2006. The program has built up a presence on campus. And from his new headquarters, SER's director, Mark Northam, is already talking about the next step. The school has already secured $10 million for new faculty, and now he needs to raise $15 million from private funders, which will be matched dollar for dollar by the state. That's for another laboratory. So far, Northam has raised $10.9 million of the $15 million he needs to reach. The donors?
The companies that have contributed to date are Baker Hughes, Marathon, Ultra Petroleum, Hess, and Shell. And we have an additional donor who hasn't, we haven't issued the press release yet, so that one I can't name.
SER's mission is to research energy, to become a leader in energy research, and to do it in a way that's beneficial to Wyoming. One major focus is unconventional reservoirs. In other words, how to better get at hard-to-reach oil and gas. So it's no surprise that energy companies would be interested in the school's success. But such concentrated corporate funding in an academic institution has some stakeholders concerned.
We are very aware of that and very upfront with both the donors and the public that, A, we do receive money from industry, but, B, they do not influence the outcomes of the research. You know, as long as we, I think, are upfront about that, we shouldn't have any problems.
But is it that easy?
I was one of the original members of the School of Energy Resources faculty, and I am one of the few in the school that's concerned with renewable energy and specifically solar energy.
That's Professor Bruce Parkinson, the solar panel guy, as he calls himself. Although research in renewable energy is one of UW's energy objectives too, Parkinson is outnumbered by fossil fuel guys at SER.
It's partially because the renewable energy industry isn't as rich and established as the fossil fuel industries, and so they don't give the big donations to the School of Energy, and therefore there's obviously then much less emphasis on it from both the number of faculty and the allocation of resources.
The advising council for SER is also dominated by fossil fuel guys, though the director of the Hope School of Environment and Natural Resources sits on it, as well as a representative from a wind company. Northam also points out that environmental advocates are invited to speak at many of SER's conferences. For Powder River Basin Resource Council board member Bob Loresh, the problem is not enough balance.
The school seems to be like a big Pac-Man amoeba sort of thing. They're kind of swallowing up certain disciplines that might be better off being independent of any specific energy influence.
For him, that's a practical problem.
We're coming to a big conflict in this state between some of the new oil and gas production methods and agriculture fighting for our very limited water resources. If the university research having to do with water resources is concentrated in the School of Energy Resources, which is funded primarily by the energy industry, that could lead to future problems, I'm afraid.
Loresh also points out that while the rest of the university was figuring out how to deal with budget cuts, SER was granted the $15 million in matching funds and $10 million for faculty. And for him, the fact that UW is Wyoming's only university is all the more reason to broaden its focus, not narrow it.
If we develop a narrow little expertise, even though it might be admired throughout the world, it's very short-sighted.
Since the mid-1960s, research and development funding from the federal government has been going down, while industry's investments steadily increase. Corporate laboratories used to do a lot of research, but they're shrinking, like the communications giant Bell Laboratories, or shutting down altogether. Vice President for Research and Economic Development at UW, William Gern, says federal funds are also getting more competitive. Still, work needs to get done. So industry is outsourcing its research needs to universities, and universities are gladly taking industry's money.
Of course, Wyoming is Wyoming, and we see a fair amount of that coming from the energy sector.
But Gern sees it as an expansion, not a narrowing of research for SER.
I see it as the basket mouth for University of Wyoming research is getting broader because of the influence that SER has had for us, and which it continues to have for us, and because of the real interest, especially in gas, oil, and coal industry. And we have a lot to give to them.
Still, while Gern emphasizes that UW must proceed, it must do so with caution.
People depend upon universities to become the neutral purveyor of information. And so the real issues that we confront in this office doesn't have to do with the veracity of the research. It really has to do with things like the publishability of the results, how graduate students can be involved in that research, and really on how we handle intellectual property issues.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, we'll look at how athletes at the University of Wyoming are doing academically. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the State Capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. One of the world's most competitive dog sled races is starting in Jackson. The International Pedigree Stage Stop Sled Dog Race will cover more than 400 miles over the course of 8 days. Joining us now to talk about the race and about dog sledding in Wyoming is Jerry Bath from Lander. He's doing the race for the 5th year in a row, and he says his dogs are bred for just this kind of event.
I run Alaskan Huskies. That's basically a mix of northern bred dogs. It's a mutt with a pedigree, so to speak. They're very, very selectively bred for what they do, whether you do sprints or mid-distance or stage racing or distance racing, similar to a horse or anything like that, performance-based. They are the best-performing, most fuel-efficient animal on the planet.
Fuel-efficient, that's an interesting word to use for an animal.
They consume massive amounts of calories, but there's been tons of studies done on the Iditarod dogs, for example, tissue samples and everything else, and they still can't figure out how they can actually regenerate while in motion. They don't have to rest. I mean, you do give them rest, but it's amazing. There's no other animal like that that can regenerate.
Now, this is a 425-mile race that spans out over more than a week. How do you and the dogs train for a race of this type of magnitude?
Keep it all fun. I've seen too many people get too serious. I just want to keep it fun. Training-wise, most everybody starts out in August, and I don't get to start until the 1st of November because of my business. I'll start out within, I'll hook them up in front of the pickup, you know, and go 5 miles, 7 miles, 10 miles every other day and work my way up to a pickup, four-wheeler, and then a snow machine, and then it's safe enough to go out with a dog sled where you can hook down and stop. I'll start using just the dog sled.
So you start with them hooked to a truck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why not? I mean, a lot of people use a four-wheeler, but all the roads I go on, you can take a pickup on. So I just take my truck with my dog box on it, and I can take young dogs, old dogs, and I can switch them in and out, you know. And it's because you have the dog box on there with all the holes and stuff that they travel in. So plus you have a heater and a radio. It's kind of a spoiled way to do it. But
then they pull you around in the truck.
They can and will, but I always put it in gear and I pace them a certain pace because I don't want them to get too muscle-bound. Like a freight dog or some dog that's hauling heavy freights, they're going to develop really big, large chest muscles. And then when you want them to really reach out and step out and speed up a little bit, they have a bigger tendency to get injured that way.
What goes into winning a race like this? I mean, is this mostly dependent on how good your dogs are, or does it have more to do with how you handle them, race strategy, pacing, things like that?
Everything's in the mix. First, there's no substitution for good genetics, just none at all. And then you have good genetics, and then if you can allow to have a good breeding program or enough money to buy dogs. So it's a little bit of everything. But no matter what my strategies are for my best laid plans, it seems like after day two, it's kind of out the window. On the stage stop, you are allowed 16 dogs on your truck, and then you're allowed to use up to 12 dogs per day. That doesn't mean you have to run 12 dogs. So the object is to get the fastest time every day and to have fresh dogs. Some dogs prefer to run every day. Some dogs one day on, one day off. Some dogs you can run 2 days on, one day off. So you could call it a science. But like anything else, too, you can overanalyze it, and then it wouldn't be fun.
Now, it seems like riding on a sled for days on end in the middle of a Wyoming winter could be pretty brutal, is it?
Oh, it can be, yeah. We can have really, really cold below zero or no visibility. You're prepared for all that. You have to pack a certain amount of safety gear with your sled, too, you know, and just common knowledge. And they just don't let anybody run a race like this. You have to be approved, so to speak, so that you can handle something like that. You know, you have to always pack a sleeping bag, a cooker, dog food, food for you, water, an axe, snowshoes, things like that, an emergency kit, so many booties per dog. You know, there's a list of mandatory gear that you have to pack every day.
Now, this race is obviously a big event every year, and teams come from all over the world. What about the rest of the year? Is there a sled dog community here in Wyoming?
Small one in Wyoming. I started. There's a few really nice family races in Pinedale, Dubois, Casper. So there's a community of that, but when you go up to professional level, there's still a bigger community of that. And what I was really surprised of 5 years ago is running at this level of professionalism, of the amount of sportsmanship and camaraderie is just outstanding. It's just second to none. Everybody's there to have a good time. Sure, they're competing against you, but they have no problem dropping what they're doing and helping you out, or if you have a question, giving them a suggestion or something like that. So it's really, really a pretty neat family.
Jerry Bath will be competing in the International Pedigree Stage Stop Sled Dog Race. Best of luck to you, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
In the 2011-2012 academic year, UW athletes involved in NCAA-sanctioned sports brought in an average GPA of 3.04. That is the highest GPA in a decade, and it's even higher than the general student body average. Wyoming Public Radio's Sarah Hosseini reports.
Women's basketball forward Chandra Sewell is a fan favorite, with nearly 1,000 points scored at UW. She's also a pharmacy student with a 4.0. She says that academics are more important to her than athletics.
I always knew I was going to go to college. As far as playing basketball in college, I wasn't so sure about.
Sewell says her high school coach encouraged her to play in college because so few women have the opportunity to play Division I basketball. And her coach here at UW assured her that education would come first.
He made it very clear to me that, you know, basketball, although it's near the top of the list, it's not the top as far as priorities go. And I really like that because I know for me personally, basketball, if I don't go on to play professional here soon, then it's probably going to end here. And so my education is what's the most important right now.
Sewell says it can be tough to succeed academically, but athletes don't have to do it on their own. All players get customized help from academic advisors who are there just for the athletes. Sarah Ray is one of those advisors.
I'll put this is online because I'm going to print this for you, and then
okay.
You can take it.
Thank you.
You have your athletic coaches, and we're kind of like the academic coaches.
Ray is the assistant athletic director for academic services. Her department provides student athletes a comprehensive range of free, sometimes mandatory services, a private computer lab, one-on-one tutoring, and study hall. They're also assigned a coordinator, like Ray, who ensures they're doing well enough to meet NCAA requirements. Ray admits that the GPA requirement isn't very steep.
The GPA requirement for freshmen is a 1.8 GPA at the end of their freshman year. After the second year, it's a 1.9, and then every year after that, it's a 2.0.
Ray says that while some teams tend to do exceptionally well in the classroom, like women's volleyball, which has an average team GPA of 3.6, others, like football and men's basketball, are much lower. She says freshmen from those teams are automatically considered academically at risk, no matter what their high school grades, and are entered into every service possible. Senior football captain Luke Ruff says it's challenging to maintain good grades because there's so much pressure on players to be great athletes.
So you're going from maybe a smaller school or maybe a smaller town, and you're coming in and you get to play in front of 10,000 people, or for football maybe 25,000, 30,000 people. And obviously you want to focus your entire time and energy to your sport because that's what you want to do.
Ruff is an engineering student with a 3.6 GPA who loves his major.
I mean, engineering is it's prestigious, you know. You get looked at as the nerd, which is great. Nerds rule the world.
That's not to say he hasn't seen fellow players struggle, even drop out. Still, the athletic department says its academic support helps ensure that not too many athletes flounder. The department spends more than $1 million a year on academic support. That's despite the fact that the athletic department barely breaks even, which raises the question, Why love the extra money to ensure that athletes make the grade? Ray says it's part of college culture.
They are ambassadors. They are a face. They represent the university.
And she says helping them succeed academically is one way to ensure that it's a positive face. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Sarah Hussein.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.